So I'm delighted to introduce today's speaker, Eric Owens. I've known Eric for almost 10 years now, believe it or not, and he's a very thoughtful and attentive person and scholar, and also a very excellent boss, too. I'll just throw that in there. Come on in. There are a few seats over here. He is currently the interim director at the Boisy Center. He's an associate professor of the practice in theology and international studies at Boston College. He's been here at the Boisy Center since 2006. His research explores a variety of intersections between religion and public life, with particular attention to the challenge of fostering the common good of a religiously diverse society. Also at the American Academy of Religion, Eric chairs the Committee on the Public Understanding of Religion. That may be something we want to talk about in the Q&A session because it's certainly relevant to today. And he also leads AAR's Public Scholars Program in partnership with several academic centers and nonpartisan institutions. He has a PhD from the University of Chicago, an MTS from Harvard Divinity School, a BA from Duke University, and he was also, during 2015-16, a research fellow at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University. This summer, Eric is team teaching a summer abroad course with Stephen Pope in South Africa on justice and reconciliation. But we'll leave it there and turn it over to Eric Owens to talk to us about the ethics of citizenship in the Trump era.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I want to start by lowering your expectations and suggesting to you that this is a conversation for all of us, not for me to tell you, but for us to talk about. And that's part of the form and content mix here in this conversation, because I'll be making a pitch for a sort of politics of the common good that requires conversation and civic engagement and engagement with others near and far. And so I hope we'll model that today. Being a professor, though, means there's an occupational hazard of talking way too long. I'll try to compress and get things out. I want to say enough for you to disagree with, but not so much that it becomes tedious. But I know that most of you will leave unsatisfied. So with that, I'm going to say a few words on the concept of citizenship. For those of you who might be outside of political theory or political science-y type world, a few words about what the concept means, talk a little bit about some of the views of or visions of citizenship I see out of this sort of chaotic cloud that is the Trump administration today, some of the visions of citizenship that's inspired in some directions. I can't be exhaustive about any of this. And then ask about whether that's enough and how we might also, what else we might add to this conversation. Most people, when you think about the concept of citizenship, if you ask someone on the street, for them it means nationality. It means what kind of passport do you hold, right? And that's a legal understanding of citizenship, which is important, and it has important ethical considerations. We've seen that around conversations around naturalization and refugee status and building certain walls and travel bans and things like that. These do all have ethical components related to whether or not you have certain rights and responsibilities as a citizen of a particular country. But that's an on or off switch in some sense, at least. You either are or you aren't a citizen of a country. You can be dual citizens, applying for citizenship, you can be naturalized, whatever, but that's a legal category that's a yes or no. I'm focusing today, and the broader kinds of conversations around citizenship are around what we'll call a normative ideal of citizenship, or one that's based on values, about membership in a political community. And in this sense, you can be a better or worse citizen, right? You can have civic values of one sort or another. It's not simply yes or no, but rather what kind, what does it look like? And this is important because our vision of what citizenship means about who we're supposed to be as a part of this political community is what sustains the institutions of our democracy. Those institutions won't stand up, let alone flourish, without people committed to them, without a particular sense of identification or respect for authority or allegiance to an ideal. And that allegiance and that sense of responsibility or respect or concern for our democratic institutions is in the cellar right now. I mean, you don't need me to tell you, but recent polls, for example, in late last year, 20% of Americans said that they had completely lost faith in democracy. Not just in like who's we elected or whether who we elected or rather whether the party in charge was going in the right direction, but in the system of democracy. And this is very troubling. I don't have historical data on this, and 20% may seem like a small number to you, but it scares me to death because the fundamental commitment we have here is to the process of democracy. And citizen is a category that's tied uniquely to democracy. If you are living under an autocracy somewhere, you're a subject, you're not a citizen. Citizen means that you participate in self-governance in some way. And if we're not committed to self-governance, then we're not committed to then we're not gonna get the product of that. And things are gonna, you know, people talk about a death spiral in the ACA, but this will be a death spiral democracy. So I don't want to be overly alarmist, but I just want to highlight the fact that commitment to this principle is a central part of what citizenship means, and we ought to be attentive to that. The second thing, by way of introduction, I'll say is that there are, of course, a million ways to think about citizenship, ways to chop it up, and categories to defend or argue against. I'm teaching a grad seminar on political theologies of citizenship right now. I mean, we're taking up a lot of these. But in many ways, the semantics, you can be overwhelmed like every academic subject on the little minutia. But there's one pretty big divide I'd like us to consider today, at least. And that is the importance placed on the public sphere versus the private sphere. And as a sort of shorthand, we'll say that a model called civic republicanism places a higher emphasis on the public sphere, which I'll talk about in a second, and a model of citizenship we can call liberal places an emphasis on the individual sphere or the private sphere. Liberalism doesn't have a single definition. Everybody argues about it, even those who identify themselves as liberal. And this sort of fluidity is compounded by the fact that it has a very strong but vague resonance as a description of party affiliation here in the United States. But I'm talking about liberalism as a civic, as a concept in civic or political philosophy. In the context of political theory, well, I'll let you all imagine what you think liberal means in the current political context or in the sort of cultural context. But in the context of political theory, liberalism describes a system of political organization that stresses natural rights, equality and freedom of the individual, and correlate support for religious toleration, equal respect, and government by consent. And in this view, our rights, which are at the fundamental core of liberalism, our rights are pre-political. Governments exist to defend those rights that exist. And whether you believe they're given to us by God or inherent in the nature of our rationality or by virtue of our duty to others or whatever, these are pre-political. So governments protect them, they don't grant them. It's a core feature of liberal theory. And also that political institutions should aim to secure the political conditions necessary for the exercise of personal freedom and especially autonomy. Again, focused on the individual. We have a structure of laws and culture in order to let us do what we want, in other words. And sometimes that what we want can be high-minded, other times it can be small-minded, but that's one of the core principles of liberalism. I'm making broad brushstrokes, right? We can argue about this later, but if there is, not at the opposite end of a spectrum, but in another category opposed in some sense, is what we'll call civic republicanism, which I'll define as a set of beliefs linking the practice of virtue with the presence of freedom and the common good of a society. Virtue, common good, freedom. And republicanism in this mode is not the grand old party, the one that runs all of our organs of government right now. It's an ancient political tradition, and it places heavy value on membership in the political community, not a community defined by race or religion or ethnicity. It's about politics, political community. And it's invested in four big things. Political participation. For some people, political participation is the only way to flourish. For some Republicans, it's the only way humans can flourish. For others, it's the pathway to flourishing. But political participation also means deliberation, being a part of the process of governing ourselves. Second of all, there's a worry that we'll call fragility, a sense that our institutions of government are fragile and that they can be corroded by a lack of commitment to the public. And so you need to have constraints and checks and balances and things like this. Third core value here is around civic virtue, and that's an inclination toward the common good, which I'll talk about later. And the pursuit of the common good is a bulwark against corruption and a corrective to individual self-interest. So if you see liberalism is providing a space for us to do what we want, republicanism is worried about that, although republicanism predates liberalism. And it sees a commitment to civic virtue and the common good as a bulwark against corruption. And finally, civic republicanism is very focused on civic education, something I care a lot about. I won't talk about today, really, but that's a crucial area that sometimes is often is left out of conversations around republicanism. All right, so with that little bit of modest political theory in the background, my talk was titled The Ethics of Citizenship in the Trump Era. But let's start by remembering how short this era actually has been. 81 days, 12 weeks, and it seems like 5 years in many ways. And it's tempting to look at the Trump administration of week 12, post-Syria chemical weapons conversation of this past 8 days, as if it's a totally different administration than week one. I don't know if you feel that way, but that's a conventional wisdom is developing that the Trump administration has found its legs now and that there's something different happening. And everyone who said all the Chicken Littles and Cassandras and worry warts out there that said this was a fascist dictator, now you can see the checks and balances have worked and they've reset themselves and people have been fired and whatever. I think that's a topic for us to talk about afterwards, whether or not that's the case. But I think the idea that we've already entered a second phase of the Trump era is pretty astonishing, given 80 days, that we're 80 days into this. I'll say that Trump's vision of American political life from where I stand is driven by binaries, right? Certainly one central binary is between the people and the elites. The people are virtuous and hardworking, the elites are corrupt and self-serving, and their swamp needs to be drained, right? As he said in his frankly scary inaugural speech, he said, from this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this moment, it's going to be America first. This is your moment. This moment is your moment. Today, the people become the rulers. The nation exists to serve its citizens. On and on, there was a conversation around the people, the people, the people. I could go back through campaign era and afterwards, but there's a very strong message that the people and the elites are different. And defining who is part of the conversation around citizenship. But the people means pure in some sense, legitimate. And those who are the elites means illegitimate and corrupt. There's a binary between fear and security, right? One of the famous or infamous articles that went out during the campaign was by Michael Anton, writing under the pseudonym Decius, who wrote an article called The Flight 93 Election, where he said this election's like the flight that was headed toward the Capitol building in 9/11, right? We either charge the cockpit or we die, he says. That's the kind of message that was put out. And this was circulated and created a huge amount of energy. And Trump himself said there will be no fear during his inaugural address. You know, we will be protected. We'll always be protected. We're going to eradicate radical Islamic terrorism. And prior to that, he said, I alone can fix this, right? So there's this sort of fear and security dialectic that he's working with. There's a dialectic of chaos and control, right? In his inaugural, he said that this American carnage stops right now. He describes the wasteland of our cities and says it's going to stop right now. His chief strategist has been talking about the deconstruction of the administrative state. They've embraced what's sometimes called the Silicon Valley model of moving fast and breaking stuff is one of the modes that they talked about. And this sort of shows that the arbitrary power that can yield a sort of chaotic cruelty in my mind around things like the travel bans announcement and whatnot. There's a binary of anti-Americanism and patriotism. Trump is an interesting case study. We could talk later about American exceptionalism, because he rejected that in many ways by saying America's not so innocent, right? We shouldn't moralize to others about what to do in the world. This is pre-Syria bombing. But also, on the other hand, of course, his campaign was built around American greatness and American exceptionalism. So there's an interesting tension that we can talk about. And of course, his vision of citizenship is about winning and losing, right? America is going to start winning again, winning like never before, he says. So it's all this as a package is about America first, which is a rejection of what some people would call global citizenship. And I hope we'll talk a little bit later about sort of the ethno-nationalist vision that's packed into this, some of the support he's gotten from explicit white nationalists, et cetera. This is all part of the cloud. So what kind of vision does this has this brought about in the culture? I think it's interesting because we know that unlike a sort of professorial predecessor, Trump isn't a systematician, right? He works by impulse. And so it's hard to really nail down a particular vision of what he thinks civic life should be. So that's why I've used the kind of concept of binaries to say what he's trying to articulate. But the responses have been, those responses that are resistant anyway, have been a couple types. One certainly has been a concern for, you know, exit and despair, right? Just the sort of apocalyptic, let's give up and move on. These are part of the 20% maybe I mentioned earlier who pretend they're going to move to Canada, write off the system, hunker down, pay attention only to their own selves. And that's these people we can write off as certainly not civic-minded. There's been a lot of satire as a response to the Trump administration, and this president is unusually susceptible to satire, I think, because we know he watches it and listens to it. But again, every president deals with this kind of thing, and it has no constructive value. It's simply deconstructive or illustrative in some ways. But the primary response that I see has been a sort of different modes of oppositional politics. Okay, citizens that have been energized first toward an ethic of resistance. We saw this acting Attorney General Sally Yates, who refused to enact the travel ban and was quickly fired. You see this from sort of rogue Twitter accounts, right, within the government. Do you remember those where the National Park Service was tweeting out climate change data and NASA and the sort of rogue EPA, et cetera? These are little things. Judith Levine in the Boston Review in February had a really pithy and nice article that she called the Bartleby strategy. She asked herself, for those of you who remember Herman Melville's short essay, Bartleby the Scrivener, he was a clerk who refused to do his boss's wishes. And whenever his boss would say why, he'd said, I prefer not to. And he never really explained why, but he also never did what his boss wanted. And he tried to get him fired, and ultimately he ended up in jail. But it was written during the early 1850s during a debate over the Fugitive Slave Act, and it's widely read today at least as a sort of a parable of civil disobedience. I prefer not to. And Judith Levine wrote this wonderful piece saying that she was walking through the New York airport on the day the travel ban came into play, and people were screaming at the TSA agents, you know, it's not your job to enact this racist travel policy. And she said she thought to herself, well, actually, it is their job, and I feel sorry for them. And then she started to say, well, maybe it's the small acts of disobedience that will create the mode of citizenship that we need today. She says, maybe it's the Bartleby strategy of saying, I prefer not to, when you're told to do something that you think is unjust, right? So this is one model of an ethic of resistance that requires solidarity. And we've seen that maybe with lawyers who have given their services to this sort of thing. But again, it's an ethic in opposition. It's a honing of oppositional politics. We've also seen a much broader oppositional politics around forms of activism that we've seen, millions of people in the streets marching for this or that. And the Women's March women were marching and men with them for all sorts of things. The people took to the streets around the travel ban. Groups like Indivisible are working to give citizens tools to stick the lever in the right place so that they can make change in the government themselves, learning how to contact people and whatever. But all of this oppositional politics, I don't think generally carries with it a vision of citizenship so much as a commitment to oppose an ethic that they disagree with. Some of it certainly does, but not all of it does. And so we have to ask whether or not that's enough. You know, whether or not this ethic of opposition is enough. And I think, for my part at least, we need a more generative politics of the common good. We need something that is richer. And we know, in our hearts, that this is an opportunity for civic renewal, that this is a challenge. This is a time, both politically, of fundamental realignment. We don't know what the different party structures will look like. We know that the politics of today are driven in large part by a sense of unaccountability in our politics. After the 2008 financial collapse, there was the rise of the Occupy movement, the rise of the Bernie Sanders coalition, on the left, the rise of the Tea Party and the Trump coalition on the right, or wherever Trump is, and the worries about economic dislocation, rising inequality, lack of social mobility, all these sorts of things, and indeed about globalization as well. It provides us an opportunity to, for us to ask as Americans and people who live in this country, you know, who are we? What do we value? What do we want this place to be that we share? And so there are a lot of visions for what a new model of citizenship might look like. And I'll mention a couple at the end. And I'm not going to give you a complete answer that you need to take. I'd like to use this as a kickoff to our conversation instead. But if I were to make this suggestion, and I am today, I'd say that a vision of citizenship for the common good starts by rejecting the liberal assumption that politics is primarily a means to protect and promote our private lives. This is the core underpinning of most modern and liberal views of citizenship, and I think it's not robust enough to generate an ethic of the common good. It's not just that people are looking out for themselves in the sense of, I want mine and you can't have it. It's more a focus on individual lives, and maybe defined, those individuals might be defined as a family, or how much leisure time you get, or what your work is like. But nevertheless, it is constricted, and it's not properly civic in the way that I would want to understand it. Second of all, I would say that a vision of citizenship for the common good would offer a vision of human flourishing that's rooted in the recognition of human interconnectedness and sociality. So this isn't giving an example of where you need, how you need to vote, or which direction you want to go in terms of your work or studies or anything like that. It's simply a recognition that the good of individuals is tied to the good of communities to which they belong, and that neither should be exalted over the other. And so as a result, this vision of the common good is an alternative to political theories and political theologies that are grounded in either individualist, whether it's liberal or libertarian modes of a certain sort, or collectivist visions, whether it's ethno-nationalist or whatever, visions of human flourishing. This still has to deal with major contemporary problems like pluralism and individualism and inequality that are conditions of our common experience. It has to deal with things like pluralism, where we know that pluralism is constitutive of the American ideal, and yet not necessarily hindrance to it, and yet we still have these, we need to have centripetal forces that pull us together in some sense. It's just that can't be whiteness that is the thing that pulls us together. There need to be religious and secular sources of this vision of human flourishing, and we see them both in civic Republican thought, which we can talk more about later, which has as its goal active and responsible citizens. We also see it, of course, in Catholic social thought and its vision of solidarity and of the common good. We see it in other recent books. I was at Kathy Caveney's conference on Friday, where she talked about a vision of religious language in the public that is tempered and not oppositional, in a sense. We see it in books like Chuck Matthews' Theology of Public Life or Phil Gorski's new book, American Covenant. And so I think that a lot of you bring these great conceptions of civic life with you too, and I hope we'll put some out on the table. The last question I have is whether or not it's possible for me to shut up? No, whether or not it's possible to fight for the common good. So this model of the common good as being somehow different than oppositional politics or something more generative or more rich in content. Is it possible to fight for this mode using oppositional politics? Or is the common good, does it require a more ironic or compromising stance? And I think this is an important question for all of us who care about both putting a real idea, a real vision of what's good out there, but also recognizing that the good fight might need to be fought as well. And I think the answer is yes, you can fight for the common good. You can stand up for it, not fight with violence, but fight as active citizens, stick the lever, elect people you want, get on the streets, make your voice known. These things can be places where people present an alternative vision for civic life rather than simply a negative response to proposals from the administration. We can merge those together, but they can't be, oppositional politics can't be at all. Millions of Americans cast their vote for Donald Trump despite his personal failings, which are legion, and they not because of them. And these voters wanted mostly pro-life and protectionist policies, not a racist authoritarian in the White House. I think there's lots of room for people to talk about and work together across this this muddled mess of an electorate that we have right now. But it's going to require something more than looking out for our own private interests. It's going to have to be a new vision, maybe not new, a revitalized vision of citizenship that looks to the public as an important space for all of us. So I hope that those of you here can answer what it is exactly we need and how that happens. But after 10 years of being a part of these symposia, I know that the best part by far is the conversation that comes. And I just want to thank you for being here and contributing to that conversation today. Thank you.